Okay, so welcome back again, everyone. And I will be finishing off this morning. So what I would like to do just to finish off is just to talk a little bit about how to kind of carry on with this sort of practice, how to take it back into your more daily life, and how to kind of make the most out of this beautiful spiritual teachings. That's where I'm going to start out, and there's also lots of questions left from last night, so I thought I'll do about 50-50. So I'll talk for about half an hour, and then half an hour I'll finish off the questions afterwards. So one of the things that I started off by saying when we started this retreat on Friday night is the idea of how much the Buddha emphasizes the happiness on the Buddhist path, and how that is so fundamental to the idea of Buddhism. Yeah, you look at how he explains meditation practice, and everything is about one stage of happiness after the other, kind of just increasing as you go along. And in a sense, you can say that the way to recognize whether you're making progress in your meditation practice, there's two kind of factors that are the are clear signposts of progress. And one is the amount of tranquility you have in your meditation, the peace you feel. The peaceometer, Ajahn Brahm calls it sometimes. And the other side of things is the extent of happiness or contentment and the sort of good feelings that you have in your practice. These are the two things that let you know whether you're making progress in your meditation or even just in your spiritual life more generally. Peace and happiness, contentment if you wish. So this is what you should look out for. And not only is this the case for the meditation practice itself. In fact, everything in the spiritual life is about these two things. So you see the Buddha in the suttas, in the discourses, he starts talking about what is known as the gradual training, which is the gradual progress on the Buddhist path. And he always starts off with morality. Yeah, and then he says very beautifully here, if you live a moral life, then you have the happiness of blamelessness. You are blameless, and because you don't blame yourself and other people can't blame you, you have a degree of happiness from that. The contentment and feeling good about yourself through the knowledge that you know you're living a blameless life. And as you keep on practicing and you're also reducing the defilements and negative aspects of the mind, you feel even more profound sense of satisfaction and happiness. This is called the Abhayaseka Sukha in the Pali language, which means like a pure kind of happiness, which isn't mixed up with all of these defilements and the problems of the mind that you otherwise find. So the whole Buddhist path is about happiness. Yeah, from the very beginning, from when you start out as being more kind, being more caring, trying to avoid the bad speech and these kind of things, the whole way, everything is about improving your sense of well-being inside. So this is wonderful. It is so wonderful, in fact, that there is nothing more meaningful than practicing the spiritual path, as far as I'm concerned. This is what life is all about. Another way of thinking about this is that the Buddhist path is profoundly meaningful. You get this feeling that you're moving towards more meaning, towards more sense of being truly alive, sense of being, finding actually an answer to the profound questions of life. That is the sense that you have on this path. You sit down, you feel peaceful, you feel tranquil. There's no more of that drive that drives you on in the world with endless desires going here, going there. But rather, you're content with what you have. And the greater your sense of contentment is in your ordinary life, the greater, when that becomes very powerful, it means that you feel there's nothing more to be done. And of course, if there's nothing more to be done, then you have, by definition, found meaning in things. You feel like this craving, this desire, the itch inside always driving you on, it's gone. One day it's gone. And when it's gone, of course, that is where you find the real sense of meaning and purpose. And this is what this path gives you. What more do you want in life? Real happiness, avoidance of sufferings and problems, and finding true meaning. There's nothing more to be asked for, really, from life. And this is what you can find on the spiritual path. So if this is what you can find, and if it is as profound as I'm suggesting it is now, then the question is, how do we get there? How do we actually do this in such a way that we actually achieve all of these levels of meaning and happiness and contentment and all of these things? The hardest part on the Buddhist path is not to understand the teachings, understand what spiritual life is all about. Everyone understands what kindness is and what morality is and all of these things. The hardest part is actually to commit and persevere in this practice. So what I want to say a little bit about is how we can actually commit in this way. What are the main factors that in the long run is going to bring you to success, especially in your meditation practice? And when the Buddha talks about meditation practice in the suttas, in his discourses, there's two things it talks about that are the foundations for any kind of meditation practice to work. And these two things are called sila in Pali, and sila means like moral habit. It means like your character, if you like, what kind of person you are. So it is kind of your sum total of your characteristics as a person. That's the one thing of it. You can call this morality if you like, but really it is much more profound than that. And the second one is view or outlook, how we think about the world. These are the two fundamental things that make the spiritual practice work. So first one, let's take the first one first, the kind of the most basic one perhaps, which is the idea of sila, of morality, or how to live well. So to be able to do this, and to be able to fulfill all of these factors and then make sure that this actually improves your meditation practice and your spiritual life. So that next time you come back on retreat, I hope you come back next time. I hope I haven't put you off by all of this kind of, sometimes this kind of ranting and raving. The Buddhists can seem a bit kind of harsh. Buddha's worldview is almost sometimes almost the opposite of the worldview of many ordinary people in the world. So sometimes it can seem a bit scary. So I hope I haven't put you off by kind of giving you too much of that side of things. But if you do come back, one of the things that you want to find out is whether you are improving. Next time you come here, is your mindfulness going to be better? Is your ability to watch the breath going to be better? Are you going to have more ability to do the metta meditation? You actually feel more of this kindness and care for other beings in the world. This is kind of where it's really at. So to be able to, this is how you actually judge whether you're making progress in a way. You see how your mind is from one retreat to the next one. You have to look over long periods of time. So how can we do that? And the only way to do that, as I mentioned before, is to integrate your spiritual life into your ordinary life, so that there is no distinction between spiritual life and ordinary life. It's not as if we compartmentalize and say, this is my ordinary things, this is my spiritual life when I come to Jhana Grove. Everything should really be part, everything should be integrated into one kind of large spiritual practice. So this is the challenge. Yes, the challenge is when you go to work, how can you think of work as not just a way of making a... of course, you need a livelihood, you need to kind of somehow survive, so of course that's part of it. But how can you also make it into something more than that? How can you make it a foundation, a place where you practice kindness, where you care for people? And this is kind of the holy grail, if you like, of the spiritual life. If you can integrate all of these aspects into your life. So think about your co-workers. How can you be kind to them? How can you care for them? Your customers, whoever it is, whoever is a stakeholder in your ordinary work life, how can you kind of deal with them in such a way to make it a spiritual path rather than purely a materialistic thing? And sometimes it doesn't take that much. Sometimes all you have to do is to say a word of kindness, to say that you appreciate somebody, you appreciate them being a colleague of yours for a long period of time or whatever. What a wonderful thing it is to have you as a colleague. You've been such a wonderful person, and you can focus on the good qualities in them. Or you can bring them something, bring them a cup of tea or whatever. Small little things that kind of enable you to create that kindness in your ordinary life. And what a wonderful thing it is if you start working and thinking like that. And this changes your outlook. It changes the way you deal with the world. Same is true with your family life. yeah, you make your family life into a spiritual path. This is often quite hard because in family life, often the habits can be very strong. Sometimes, if someone is very close to you, all they have to do sometimes is say that same thing they've said a million times before. I've told you this a million times. Yeah, don't say that. It really upsets me. And this is the thing, the habits are very, very powerful in ordinary family life. So it's actually a very powerful place to practice the spiritual life because you learn to overcome those habits. How can you think about your family members in a more constructive way? Remember, they are conditioned. Remember, the way they behave is often because they don't have much choice in the way they behave, just their habits coming out. And it's useful to think of people a little bit like robots. But they are robots who suffer from their own programming. They are their own worst enemies because of their program. So think of people a little bit like that. And then you can have compassion for them. You can say, yeah, it's okay. You know, give them a pat on the back. It's all right. Give them a hug. Don't worry. I understand. Instead of getting upset, you have compassion, understanding instead. This is how you shift. You use all the ordinary experience in life as a ground, as a basis for the spiritual life, for building up understanding, compassion, kindness, all of these beautiful qualities. And then gradually, things kind of grow and things start to change in your life. The idea of morality in Buddhism is subdivided into many different aspects, and it can be quite useful to read about that, to understand what right speech and right action is considered as in the Buddhist teachings. It can be quite helpful. But what it really comes down to is the idea of kindness. Kindness in actions, kindness in speech, and also even kindness in the way we think about the world and the way we think about people. If you can integrate kindness into your life, and kindness means actively being kind, and also it means avoiding the bad things. This is why it's such an all-encompassing term. So if you can integrate that kindness into your life fully, then you're going to go a long, long way on this Buddhist path. So this is the first thing. So see if you can do that in your life. Now, the other thing which is very important on the Buddhist path, which I mentioned before, is the idea of right view. And in many ways, right view is even more foundational than being kind. And the reason for that is because to be able to be kind, well, why are we kind in the first place? It's because we have a certain view about things. And the view that supports kindness is, of course, the view that kindness matters. It is important. So how can we kind of build up that view that kindness actually matters? This is one of those important things in life. If you can build that up, then it's almost as if that view is at the back of your mind, always kind of watching over you and guiding you in the right way. If you don't have that view, if you kind of rely on just an intuition or whatever that kindness is good, sometimes you will just make mistakes, you will go wrong. The stronger that view is, the stronger the intuition is, and the more it will guide you in ordinary life. It's so easy to lose it, when you are around people all the time and you are kind of very busy. It is so easy to forget about these things. So that perseverance is really the hard part. So by having the right view, it is this guiding thing at the back of your mind which ensures that you keep this at the top of your agenda at all times. So what is that right view? And one example of that right view, which I already mentioned before, is the idea that the external world is so uncertain. We just don't know. We cannot control the external world. If there's anything we can control, it is the inner world. It is how we think about others. It is how we act. This is one way to think about it. So don't worry so much about the external world. It is out of control. So this is one idea of right view, knowing where to look for happiness, knowing what can actually give you satisfaction in the long run and what will never be able to give you that satisfaction. Another of the famous similes that I like to teach on these retreats is a simile that I always found very meaningful. It was very meaningful to me. I don't know if it's going to be meaningful to you, but to me it was very, very meaningful in kind of giving me that guidance on what matters in life. And this is a simile called the simile of the borrowed goods in the suttas. The Buddha says that all the pleasures of the world are like the borrowed goods. So what are the Yeah, so the pleasures of the world, yeah, they are kind of everything, basically everything in the world, everything outside of you that gives you some sense of happiness or pleasure or meaning or whatever it is. And the Buddha says it's like someone who borrows something. Yeah. In the sutta, because this is an ancient India, they borrow a carriage, and then they borrow some, you know, nice jewelry or whatever, and then they drive around as if they are really wealthy, because that's how you kind of, had a kind of ostentatious wealth in those days. That's all you really required, a bit of jewelry and a carriage, and driving around with a horse and thing, and then you were considered really wealthy already. So it was quite simple at that time. But because they are borrowed, yeah, and then you drive around and people say, wow, look at this person, yeah, they're really wealthy. This is how the wealthy enjoy their wealth, by driving around like this. And of course, once you get to that, you also identify with it a little bit. Yeah, that's right, I'm wealthy, yeah, okay, you this is me, this is who I am. But because it's borrowed, it only takes so long. And then the owner says, okay, now you have borrowed it long enough, give it back to us. Yeah, it gets taken away from you again. And the problem is that if you identify with that, if you attach to those things because they are borrowed goods, you're going to suffer a lot when it's taken away from you. Not only that, but because it is borrowed goods, it is not, doesn't have any lasting satisfaction to it. Before you know it, it's gone. And the Buddha says, this is exactly what the things in the world are like. All the things in the world are like borrowed goods. So what are these things that are borrowed goods? Well, so many things in your life are borrowed goods. Everything you own in this life are borrowed goods. You're going to have them for a while. Yeah, you're going to your possessions are going to kind of they're going to support you for a while. Your house, your car, whatever it is, all the things that are most dear to you. Maybe your clothes, whatever it is that you have it for a while, and then before you know it, it's gone. Sometimes it burns down in a bushfire. Yeah, this is the reality of living in Australia. It's certainly things are just gone in a bushfire. And it is interesting. You see, sometimes you read about the tragedies of people losing everything in a bushfire. And people are distraught. Yeah, really, really distraught. It's terrible. Because everything in your life, everything you feel you have built up, it's gone. But that is the reality. At the very latest, when you die, it's going to have to go. If not a bushfire, it's going to happen anyway. This is the reality of things. And because things in the world are like borrowed goods in this way, you start to realize it is not appropriate, it is not going to be useful to invest too much in things that are borrowed. Because if I do that, it's going to be problematic down the road. So your possessions are all borrowed goods. Our relationships in this world are borrowed goods. Yeah, the people who are most dear to us, eventually it's going to have to go. So you are really realistic about life. I'm not saying this to make you depressed. Are you feeling depressed? I apologize. No? You're okay. I'm saying this because this is kind of an outlook which matches with reality. And if you're going to be realistic about things, then the option opens up to take a different path, if you like, look at things in a different way, and then live in a life which is more skillful, in a life where actually there is some potential for happiness down the road. All our relationships are going to have to go. They are borrowed goods. The people who are most close to us. Yeah. And again, it is kind of traumatic when you think about it, but we know it's true. It has to be that way. So again, you don't invest in these things in the wrong way, because if you invest in these things in the wrong way with too much attachment, too much desire, it's going to hurt down the track. Yeah? Then there is your physical body. Yeah, how much are you going to look after your physical body? It's also going to end up in a place which is not so nice. Yeah, it's going to be end up in the kind of in Karakata or Fremantle. It's going to be kind of be a little pile of ash eventually, probably, these bodies. And sometimes we spend so much time looking after these physical bodies as if they really matter. But the physical body is also just a borrowed good. It only lasts so long. And there's even more. Yeah, one of the interesting things that so much of our identity, who we think we are, is also tied to this human existence of ours. Our education, our status, our work, our position in a family, our position in the larger society, all of these things, all these connections that we make in life, this kind of makes up our identity. And yet so much of our identity is tied to this world. Yeah, I kind of think that I'm a Buddhist monk because I look like this. Yeah, so I think, yeah, but actually, am I, you know, once you die, I can't take these things with me when I die. Or can I? What do you think? Yeah, probably not, yeah? These are going to have to be left behind. So again, you don't identify too much with having a short haircut because, again, that you don't know what's going to happen when you when you have to give up this body and you have to give up this life. So this identity business is also problematic. And of course, this is part of the things that we give up through meditation practice. And once you start to see the world in this way, you ask yourself, how much time, how much effort, how much energy should I invest in these things that are just borrowed? Yeah, when I die, I'm going to have to give it all up. What's the point? Imagine you come into a deathbed and it happens sooner than you think. I'm always shocked that suddenly people just disappear. They're gone. And one day it's going to be each one of us. Don't think that when you read in the newspaper, this is about, you know, someone has died, that this is about other people. When you read that someone has died in the paper, it's about you. It is not that this is another person. Yeah, yeah, it's not going to happen to me. This is other people. This is the reality of all human life. There was an interesting piece of research that was done recently. I think at, I can't remember, university somewhere in, was it in Israel or something like that? And they had asked people, you know, how they react when they read about someone's death in the newspaper. And the reaction is always, oh yeah, that's someone else. Yeah, it's got nothing to do with me. Someone else is dying. And this is how we tend to think about death. But when you read about someone dying in the newspaper, you should remember that could be you. You are no different from that person. It's not as if that person, they have been careless, whereas you are careful. Yeah, you look after your health. When you cross the street, you look to the left and you look to the right, so you're not going to be run over by some careless driver or whatever. But it isn't really like that. Life is inherently uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen around the corner. So when you read about someone dying, remember, that could be you. Yeah, it is always around the corner. And in this way, it makes this whole thing about things being borrowed goods in the world more real. It actually is very, very real. So we need to change how we think about how we invest our time, our energy, and this short life that we have. How do we invest it? And what you want to invest it in is not those things that are borrowed goods. Because when you come to your deathbed, you are lying there and you think, I'm losing everything. I spent my whole life building up all of these things, all of these relationships, this beautiful family, all of these belongings I have. I've spent my whole life doing it. Now I have to go. It feels terrible if that's all you have done and now you have to leave it all behind. And sometimes if the worldly things are the ones that mean the most to us, what it means is that you act often in immoral ways to acquire those worldly things. Because if they are really what matters in your life, then sometimes you will kind of discard your morality in the pursuit of these worldly aims and possessions. So not only can't you take anything with you, but you have dragged yourself down in the process. And then when you die with a worse mind state than the mind state you had when you came into this world. You have let yourself down, essentially. And then on your deathbed, you feel really confused. You feel really terrible. And of course, that is not going to have good results for the future. So the question then is, how can we invest for the longer term rather than for the short term? This is really the important question here. And of course, the answer, you know it already. The answer is to imbue our life with spiritual qualities. Instead of worrying too much about whether a relationship is going to work out or not, instead of worrying about, you know, whether we're going to be able to secure certain possessions or not, instead of worrying too much about where the world is heading, because it is all of these things out of control, we ask ourselves about the quality that we put into our life. Yeah, how can I, instead of worrying about the promotion and the kind of increase in a salary that I might have down the track, instead, how can I be more kind? How can I be more caring? So I build up good qualities in myself, and I also at the same time contribute to society in a very positive way, building up society in a positive way. This is the right attitude. So it is not so much that you need to change your life dramatically. It doesn't mean that you have to become a monk or a nun or anything like that. What it really means is that your attitude to life is different. You think about your life in a different way. It's almost like an inner transformation. Outwardly, it may look like you are exactly the same person. You have the same family, the same job. But inwardly, your attitude is different. Instead of pursuing empty things that will never satisfy you, that will never get you anywhere, instead, you pursue the process itself. You make sure the process is right. You do things in a way that actually gives rise to good feelings inside. Because these good feelings that you build up by living well, this is what you take with you when you die. And if you have built up a bright and beautiful mind throughout this life, when you come to your deathbed, you're about to die, you think, yay, I've lived well, I've done the right thing, I feel good about myself, I've gone somewhere, I started out down here, now I'm here. What a wonderful thing. Okay, all the material things, all the family, it is a bit sad that I have to give it all up, but I can deal with that because I've built up something more powerful, something beautiful in my heart and in my mind. And this is what you will take with you into the future. And this is the Buddhist idea of karma, yeah, the idea that we bring with us the qualities of our heart into the future life when we pass away in this way. This is how you make meaning out of things. This is how you use the idea of right view to make that commitment and carry on persevering in living well. So this is what I mean by right view, right outlook. It is so simple. And I'm sure that most of you, maybe all of you here, would agree, at least to some extent, that this is true. Yeah, because it's so obviously true. How could it not be true? And yet somehow we sometimes forget these things in our ordinary, in our life. Even as a monk sometimes, you forget about these things. So you need to bring it back again and again and again. And the way to do that, to remind yourself of these ideas of right view, and then the right view to support your morality and kindness, the way to do that is to come back to spiritual teachings. And I would obviously advise you to come back to the Buddhist teachings, yeah? I'm just a little bit biased in that area. So come back to the spiritual teachings. Listen to good talks, come back to the word of the Buddha, whoever that you know you trust in, as far as good spiritual teachings are concerned. Come back to these things and allow it to brainwash you a little bit. You are brainwashed anyway, let's face it. Yeah, we're all brainwashed because that's kind of what conditioning is all about. So you need some good brainwashing here. So come to the Buddha and allow him to kind of clean out your brains a little bit, and then things will get much better as a consequence. Come back to these teachings to remind you of what matters in life again and again and again. Every time you feel like you are losing track a little bit, or even just to remind you to reinforce things that you already know. And as you do that, this right view will kind of gradually become established inside of you and will enable you to live life to far greater effect in terms of what gives rise to true happiness and contentment and meaning in life. So this is what it is all about. To, again, come back to one of the beautiful similes of the Buddha that I always teach on these kind of retreats. And as the Buddha's beautiful simile of the rain on the mountaintop. The Buddha says that if you come back to the foundations, if you come back to listening to good teachings, if you allow yourself to be conditioned by things that are positive, that lead you in the right direction, that is like the rain on the mountaintop, yeah? And as that conditioning practice happens, and all of these other things happen almost automatically, because you are inspired by good spiritual teachings, you start to act accordingly. Because you start to act accordingly, your meditation improves. As your meditation improves, you find even more meaning and purpose in life. When this becomes very powerful, eventually you get profound insights into reality, yeah? So the whole thing starts off by listening to good spiritual teachings, and the whole thing eventually leads to awakening through a natural process. And really all you have to do is to listen to these teachings, and then everything else happens as a matter of course. It sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? All you do is listen to good spiritual teachings, everything else happens? I don't believe that. Okay, this is what the Buddha said, so please try and to see if you can make sense of it. What the Buddha says, it's like the rain on the mountaintop. If you allow the rain to fall on the mountaintop, if it keeps on falling and falling and falling, eventually it forms into little streams. The little streams go down the mountainside, and if the rain keeps coming, those little streams become bigger and they merge into larger streams. If it keeps on raining, those larger streams eventually reach the lakes. If it keeps on raining, the critical thing here is that it keeps on raining on the mountaintop. This is the critical issue, yeah? Keeps on raining on the mountaintop, eventually those lakes fill up. If it keeps on raining, when the lakes fill up, eventually they flow over, and they go into larger lakes. If it keeps on raining even more, eventually the large lakes also fill up. If it keeps on raining, eventually the large lakes overflow, they go into the large rivers, and the large rivers go all the way to the ocean. The ocean here is a simile for the end of the path, yeah? The simile for insight, for understanding, for having an idea of the nature of reality. And all you have to do is to ensure that the rain falls on that mountaintop. What is, again, the rain falling on the mountaintop? The rain falling on the mountaintop is coming back to the good spiritual teachings, coming back to people who have an understanding of these things, yeah? Again and again and again. And as you do so, gradually, 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 you move towards everything you ever wanted in your life. The highest happiness, the end of all suffering, and finding true and real and lasting meaning. Everything is there if you allow that rain to keep on falling on the mountaintop. This is how you make the most out of this spiritual practice. This is how you commit to the Buddhist path, and this is how you persevere. It sounds very simple, but if you keep on doing this, you will find out for yourself that it starts to work in your own life. And what a wonderful thing that is when that actually starts to happen. So, that is what I suggest you should do. Don't have to do it if you don't want to, but that's kind of my suggestion. It's really, really up to you. So see how it works out for you. And you may find that you have no choice. It just kind of happens that way anyway, because sometimes this spiritual practice, once you start to get a feeling for it, you realize that actually there's something very powerful and wonderful going on here. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to not talk much more. I'm going to have a look at some of the remaining questions from yesterday. Yeah, another 25 minutes or so. And then that will be the end of it after my 25 minutes. So we'll see how far we go. I'll try to be a bit faster than yesterday, and then we'll see if we can get through it all even, perhaps. Okay, so during meditation, how do you stop the internal chatter? I don't have mental images, just an internal voice in the background. So I think I've talked about this quite a bit already. Yeah, so the idea here is to find happiness somewhere else. We attach to the chatter, we enjoy the chatter because we may not have that happiness in the meditation practice, and also to take away the importance of that chatter. The reason why we like to do it is because we think it's important. But if you understand how empty it is and how pointless it is, and the really important part is actually the spiritual path, it tends to die down as a consequence. Okay, do you believe the Buddha is just one of many ascended beings, such as Jesus and Omram, okay. Or do you feel the Buddha is the ascended being? So in other words, the one who has gone the furthest on the path. One of the things the Buddha says, one of the interesting things that makes the Buddhist teachings kind of unique in a way, and this is actually how the Buddha describes his own teachings compared to, and what he compares it to is the kind of the hegemonic religion at that time, which was Brahmanism. Brahmanism is the precursor to Hinduism today. And of course, Brahmanism is in many ways similar to other religions in the sense that they have a kind of an all-powerful deity, which is like the background of the entire universe. In many ways, similar to the idea of a Christian creator god or something like that. And what the Buddha says is that there's one thing where Buddhism is completely different from all other religions, and that is this idea of non-self. Yeah, the idea of a creator god is very similar to the idea of a soul, the idea of some inherent essence in human beings. Yeah, it's the kind of internal essence and the external essence. The god is like the external essence, the internal essence is the soul. These are very closely related ideas. And Buddhism is different. It doesn't have that concept. So if the Buddha was right and the Buddha saw through this, then It would seem to me that his teachings actually went further than other spiritual teachings into the insight into reality. The whole point of Buddhism is an insight into reality, and this is the critical insight into reality that the Buddha talks about, this insight into non-self. So to me, it seems like the Buddha has discovered something that very, very few other beings are capable of understanding. Okay. How can we stop thinking of the past, the regrets of what we did or did not do, or the anger at somebody having done something to us? So I talked about that yesterday as well, the idea of you have to learn to forgive. Remember, people are conditioned. People usually want to be kind, but even if they want to be kind, they can't be kind. That is often sometimes the tragedy for human beings. And you know that's probably true for yourself as well, even though you would like to be kind at all times. Sometimes conditions conspire against you, and you're not able to be kind, even though you actually would like to be kind. Yeah, I'm sure you've all felt that sometimes. That is kind of the sadness and almost the tragedy of people's lives sometimes. Then you can have compassion because you understand that it's difficult sometimes to be human or to be any being at all. We are about to have a baby. What do you recommend we do in order to remain calm and mindful after she is born? I'm not sure if it's possible to be calm and mindful after you have a baby. So what you do, what you have to do is you have to see again, you have to see this whole idea of having a family as a part of your spiritual practice, yeah? Having a baby is a wonderful opportunity to develop kindness and compassion, to help someone else into this world and to help them in the best possible way to achieve happiness and to achieve all the good things, even on the spiritual path. It's interesting. I was recently reading an article about a group of people called antinatalists. Have you heard about antinatalists before? I've never heard of them before. I read this article. And apparently these are people who are against giving birth. They say bringing people into existence is evil, they say, because it's evil. Why? Because human life is fraught with suffering. So you shouldn't actually bring anyone into existence. You should refrain from giving birth to anyone, and you should make sure that you don't have any babies and that sort of stuff. So antinatalists, yeah? And apparently there's quite a few people who feel like that. Maybe there are some antinatalists right here in the crowd. Maybe I'm an antinatalist, I'm not sure. But the question is, does it work? And the answer is that what brings people, other beings, into existence is not the act of procreation. That is not actually what brings people into existence. From a Buddhist point of view, what brings you into existence is your own craving. The fact that you crave for future existence means you're going to be born somewhere. So the question is not whether you're going to get born or not. The question is only where you're going to get born. So if you refuse to have children in your life, it just means that a person is going to be reborn somewhere else. That's really all it means. And that changes the equation a little bit, because what that means is that if you are good people, yeah, and presumably you are a very good person, yeah, because otherwise you wouldn't be here, as I like to say, yeah, it means that if you are a good person with good values, with good intentions, who wants to do what is good in the world, it means you can bring somebody up with those good values, and you can make their life much more bright, happy, and good because of your own values. And that is what this really is about. Yeah. So we shouldn't it's not necessarily wrong to have a child. I think sometimes it can be the right thing, depending on what kind of life you have. But at the very least, if you do, then make it into a spiritual practice. And then you can aid someone else in this world to gain a fulfilling and nice life. This is what it's really all about. This is the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say, if you're going to have a child, always remember that any child that comes into existence, they often come with a pre-existing personality. This is the Buddhist idea of rebirth. We don't come into this world as a blank slate and you can kind of control this child and make them whatever you want to be. That's impossible. You remember that you have very limited abilities as a parent to shape the life of that child, yeah, because they already have a large extent, they have a personality already. You can help them a little bit, but to a large extent, they're going to have to go their own way. And this is where, as a parent, you have to learn to let go. You have to allow your child to go its own way. And this, in a sense, is the greatest act of love you can have for a child or for any being. Not to control them, but to allow them to go their own way. You help them on the path. You give them some good advice every now and again. But in the end, they're going to have to do what they want. Yeah, and this is a great act of love because it's a letting go. It's an allowance. Okay, if you want to be, if you want to work, you know, if, whatever you do in life, I'm not going to demand of you to be very successful. I'm not going to demand of you to be a great spiritual person. I'm not going to demand anything of you. You make your life, out of your life, whatever you want. That is the best way of being. Just give love, give support. That is the job of a parent. This is very hard to do. And you won't always succeed in that because there will obviously be some attachments there between parent and child. But that is kind of the ideal. Keep that at the back of your mind. And what happens, the kind of the magic that happens if you're able to do that, usually the life of that child turns out to be a very good one. Why? Because they feel secure inside of themselves. They have been loved. They have been cared for. When they go out into the world, they will feel at ease around other people and other beings. And that is the best way to have a good starting point in life. Okay, so that's setting the bar very high, but that's some advice for you anyway. Okay, are the thoughts that come and go completely random, or is there a reasoning behind them? The thoughts and that come and go, they are not completely random. They come because of conditioning from the past, yeah? And you will see that because you will see that a lot of the thoughts that you have are about things that have happened to you in the past, yeah? They come back to you. And sometimes you think about the future, and of course that future also is conditioned by various things, how you think about it. So it's not really random. And what is interesting about the thinking mind is that the reason why you think is not because thoughts just come to you. The reason why you think is because you want to think. Yeah, there's actually an intention there. It's a desire to think, and that's why the thinking comes. So this is very hard to see because it feels like the thoughts just come into our minds, but actually we desire it. And because we desire it, that is also part of the solution to finding an end to thinking. If you find something else that you desire more, like peace and joy and all these kind of things, then your thoughts are going to go out of the window and you're going to be peaceful as a consequence. Okay, in seated meditation, is it normal to feel like you are dozing off? It is very, very normal. Does that mean we are not doing it right? It does not mean you're not doing it right. It just means that you need to doze off a little bit. And remember, there is no right or wrong here. There's only the development of the mind. If the mind needs rest, then it is right to doze off. How do we know we are advancing in our meditation practice? Okay, that's a very good question. How you know is that don't worry too much about what happens during a single retreat. Instead, come back again next year or come back again in 6 months or go to some other place, do some more meditation practice and then compare. Yeah, compare if your mindfulness is improving. Are you feeling, it's actually an overall thing. Yeah, it's about all the various factors of the Buddhist path, not just the mindfulness. Are you feeling more gentle as a person? Are you feeling more tolerant? Is your ability to follow the breath or meditation object, is it improving in all of these things? Are you improving in good qualities and declining in bad qualities? Are you getting less angry, for example? Yeah, this is one of the very important criteria for deciding whether you are moving in the right direction or not. As long as you are improving in good qualities and declining in the bad ones, you're making progress. And that's not just my word. A lot of the things I say are taken directly from the Buddha's discourses. This is how the Buddha said we should see whether we're heading in the right direction or not. Okay, can you explain how mala beads are used for meditation? Should they be used? Mala beads are like these beads that are often used by Tibetan Tibetans, Tibetan monastics. You will see them if you you know, if you have been around Tibetan Buddhists, and they use them as a way of sometimes just counting, as a way of focusing. You count the mala beads or whatever. Is it good? Everything is judged by its outcome. Yeah. So if it makes you peaceful, it makes you mindful, it kind of aids you in the right direction, then it can be useful. So see if it works for you. If your mind is very scattered or whatever and you want to kind of have something to focus on, you can use the mala beads. And then after a while, you feel better, you can put them to one side and you can kind of come back to your breath or whatever. So ask yourself how it affects you. That's how you know if it's good or not. Dear Ajahn, how can we love ourselves when we just feel ashamed and not proud of who we are? Okay, so what you have to do is that you have to, change your perceptions a little bit. Look at yourself in a different way. Remember your good qualities. Remember that you are here, for goodness sake. You are in a place of spiritual practice. You are trying to do your best. Your intentions are there. Your heart is in the right place. What a wonderful thing that is. So you just need to learn to refocus a little bit. And maybe you have been conditioned in your life to always look at your own faults. This is one of the problems of societies. I think it's almost universal around the world, how we are brought up to always thinking about faults and negative things and all of these kind of things. Don't do that. Remember your good qualities. Everyone here has a good heart. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Everyone here is at least inclining in the right direction. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. What a wonderful thing that is. So remember that. Remember these good things inside of you. Don't dismiss that as something not important. It's incredibly important. It is very praiseworthy. It is very wonderful that people actually want to live a life for the betterment of themselves and the betterment of others. So well done for even being here. It's wonderful to have you here. So think like that. And the problem is the habit. So by starting to think like that, gradually you change that habit and gradually you start to see the good qualities in yourself. And I would really recommend you also to start doing that with other people, because if you start to see the good qualities in other people, you will start to see them in yourself. We are not able as human beings to divide up and kind of say, me over here, I am really good, but these people are really bad. It doesn't really work like that, except maybe if you are very narcissistic or something. But if you're an ordinary person, you tend to view other people badly, you view yourself badly. So look at other people in the same way. See the good qualities. Tell them how you appreciate their friendship or their companionship or colleagueship or whatever. And tell them specifically what it is about. And then you start generally to look for good things in life and people and the world. And then things start to change. And you start to feel much better about yourself. Remember that you are conditioned. Remember that the way you are is because of your past, your parents, your whatever it is. Forgive yourself any faults that you may have. It's not your fault. It's a miracle that people are good at all in this world. What a wonderful thing it is every time you see someone's good quality. What a marvelous thing it is that people have been able to kind of get out of the conditioning of society or whatever it is and actually be able to be good despite all the conditioning. If you think in this way, it starts to gradually, you grow out of the problems and you start to see things in a new way. But again, you have to be committed, you have to persevere, and as you do that, life starts to take shape in a different direction. Okay, I think we might just make it, which is nice. What is consciousness? Is it awareness? Or vijnana, is this also subjected to change? What is consciousness? Well, consciousness is, it depends who you ask, but if you go to the Buddhist idea of consciousness, really it is, as you say, it is awareness. Vijnana is just the ancient Pali word that is used to express this idea. So it's just the ability to know. The fact that you are here now, you can hear, you can see or whatever, that is consciousness. You have the ability to know what's going on. If there was no consciousness, everything would just be dark. There would be nothing happening at all. That's what it is. It is also subject to change. It is. And this is because consciousness varies with the senses. So one thing is to be aware of sight. That's called sight consciousness. Hearing is another kind of consciousness. Yeah, you hear something. Then there is just the mind consciousness, which is what happens in meditation when the senses disappear. That is just purely the mind. Then there is the touch, physical body consciousness, smell and taste. Six kind of consciousnesses in Buddhism. And these are all different consciousnesses. And they come and go. And there's no link between them. And this is one of the ways in which you can see profoundly into the idea of non-self, that there's nothing permanent, no permanent essence inside of you. Okay, what do you recommend that I do when I have anxious thoughts, both during meditation and throughout the day? Anxiety is a little bit like fear. Yeah, anxiety is almost always about the future and that things might go wrong or something like that. The thing to do is to try to understand. First of all, try to get some insight what it is that you are anxious about. And very often there will be particular things that you have been conditioned to be anxious about. And then you can start gradually to reprogram your mind. Look at the alternative outcomes. I always think that it will be a bad outcome. Why do I think it will be a bad outcome? In your life, has your life, if you look back on your life, has everything always been a bad outcome? And chances are it hasn't. So why do you think it's going to be like that in the future? It's just a conditioning that somehow you have received from the past. So recondition yourself. Remember all the good outcomes that may come. And very often we don't even know what a good outcome is. Sometimes we are anxious about things that actually turn out to be a blessing. This is this idea of good, bad, who knows again. In the long run, the point is, if you are practicing on a spiritual path, if you're doing all the right things, you are pretty much assured that the long-term outcomes will be positive and good as a consequence. This is kind of the way to think about this. Okay, there will be problems on the way. Things may go wrong, but there's nothing really to be all that anxious about, because in the long run, you're going to overcome this and things are going to be better as a consequence. So it is a little bit of reprogramming. Again, you have to be persistent with this, but if you keep on being persistent and doing the right thing, eventually those things will gradually, they will disappear. How can another person share the merits with you when doing an offering? How does it work? Okay, so the idea, this is kind of a Buddhist idea of sharing merits. You're not really sharing merits. What you are doing is that you are doing an act of kindness and then other people are kind of rejoicing in it. That's really the idea. So you do an act of kindness, and then when other people see you doing that, whether they are departed, they have died already, or whether they are present, everyone is gaining more merit. This is the easy way of doing things, yeah? If someone else is doing an act of kindness, they think, yay, well done, wow, I'm so happy you're doing this. You are making merit for yourself just by thinking like that. It's so easy to making merit just means creating happiness for yourself. That's really what it means. So sometimes it's so easy, it's just in the attitude, how we actually think about things, whether we create good karma, whether we create merit, whether we create happiness for ourselves. So in the case of, say, someone is departed, and maybe they are still around, maybe they're hanging around as a ghost or something, they can't really let go, and then they see a family member doing an act of merit on their behalf, they will think, yay, thank you so much, you're doing this for me, wow, I'm so happy now. And bang, they get reborn in a higher place, because you are trapped in that ghost realm by your negative thinking or whatever. This is really how it works. So not really transferring anything, it's just everyone kind of rejoicing in what is going on. So very useful to rejoice in other people's good actions. Mudita in Pali. What can I do to bring my children together? One will no longer speak to anybody in our family since she has gone through some terrible abuse by a person who drugged her. Family not so bad, but her sister is heartbroken. She will no longer speak with her because of her partner she now has. What can you do to bring your children together? Sometimes you have to give things time. Because sometimes people need time to see that there is a problem. They need time to kind of get things sorted out. Remember, at the end of the day, it is not really in our power to make other people see right or see wrong or whatever. Very often, these things just have to happen naturally. They have to be ready. And when they are ready, then things can sometimes happen on their own. So your job is really just to continue to be kind, yeah? Continue to do the right thing. Continue to show that love of a parent and to do what is right, no matter how difficult it may be. And then over time, things will often resolve themselves. It is very hard to kind of to make other people do the right thing. But if you are kind, that is when you have the greatest chance that people will start to look at themselves. It's almost like you become a mirror to the other person. One of the interesting things about this idea of becoming a mirror is that if someone is angry with you, but you don't react, you just look at them with kindness or whatever, they start to become a bit self-conscious very quickly. Yeah, it's almost as if they start, instead of looking at you, you are the object of the anger. If you don't react and you have a sense of compassion towards them because you know that they are hurting and you look at them with kind eyes, then suddenly it doesn't take long before they feel a bit uncomfortable with that. Because when you're angry, you kind of expect a reaction from the other person. And in this way, you become like a mirror for the other person. They start to reflect on themselves. So instead of being critical of your children for the argument they have or whatever, instead have love. And when you have love, it is more likely they will start to reflect on their own conduct, and then they may change the way they deal with things. Sometimes through my life, I seem to know when something is going to happen. My family makes jokes about it. They are a bit spooked. So can you explain this? this is, I have heard many, many examples of this happening. Yeah, so this is quite a common experience. I've heard of people having kind of premonition dreams or premonition ideas, and then reality turns out to be exactly the premonition. For example, you may have see a certain house in your dream, and then a few weeks or months later, you find yourself, you go travel overseas, and you find yourself exactly in that house. You think, whoa, this is it. And you kind of, it's a bit spooky. And exactly how that works, I'm not sure. But the point is that the world is much more interconnected than sometimes we think it is. And sometimes for that reason, it is possible to have these premonitions about the future. So it is nothing to worry about. Of course, if you see something potentially disastrous happening, then maybe you want to kind of see if you can avoid it, because maybe that premonition is telling you that if you do the right thing, you can actually avoid it. It may not be absolutely set in stone or in concrete just because you have the premonition. It may just be, this is what's going to happen if you allow things to flow the way they are going now. But if you make a change, you might be able to avoid that problem in the future. So in a sense, it is like it's a wonderful thing, yeah? If you have a chance, if it gives an opportunity to change something, maybe it can be a very helpful thing. So see it as a blessing. See it as something that you can use to kind of help others and help yourself to avoid potential problems in the future. Okay, last question. Wow, that's amazing. I thought we'd never get there, but now we have. I thought it would take to the end of samsara before we got to the end of these questions, but fortunately not. Okay, last one. I'm just curious, why do Buddhist monks shave their head and yogis do not shave? You are welcome to shave your head if you like. Yeah, we can have, maybe we should have a retreat where everyone has to shave as they enter the main hall. Yeah, we have two people standing there shaving everyone. Is that a good idea? You're doing pretty well already, so you're there. It wouldn't be so bad for you. So yeah, please shave your head, yeah? And it's kind of, the idea, the reason why you shave your head is an act of renunciation, because hair tends to be very important to people. Yeah, hair is kind of, if you look around the world, you see all the hairstyles people have and all kind of things. It's very important to show an idea of who you are as a person and all of these kind of things. And so it is a kind of an extension of your personality. So when you shave off your hair, We all look pretty much the same. Yeah, we look pretty much the same. Yeah, the clothes are a bit different, but otherwise we are kind of heading there. So this is the nice thing about it. It's the idea of diminishing your sense of self. And this is what happens in your meditation anyway. Yeah, you will have noticed that when you become peaceful, actually there isn't that much sense of self there. Yeah, it's like you are gradually disappearing. And the deeper your meditation is, the less sense of self you have. Yeah, and this is kind of, and it is so nice. This is the weird thing. Most people in the world, they want to build up a sense of self, a feeling for who they are, an ego that they can build up, not really understanding that it is fraught with suffering and problems and all kinds of things. Far better not to have that sense of self. So anyone who has a little bit of experience with meditation will actually be so happy to get rid of all of this ego business, all of these feelings about who you are as a person. And it's interesting. I was just telling to someone the other day that in one of the suttas of the Buddha, he says that one of the last defilements that are problematic on the Buddhist path is the defilements of thinking a bit about your reputation, about who you are, about your sense of self, where you come from, about your family and all of these kind of things. So the sense of self can very often interfere in the meditation practice. When it gets too quiet, we feel that we are disappearing. And sometimes there's something inside of you that reacts to that. You don't want to disappear. You want to be here. You want to feel that you are somebody. So being able to let go a little bit of the sense of self is actually very useful in the long run, because it also allows you to go into deeper meditation as a consequence. So that's why we shave our heads, so we can have less sense of self. It's nice, isn't it? Very easy to look after. Yeah, no need to kind of wash your hair. Sometimes we get shampoo in the monastery. It's weird, isn't it? People give us shampoo. I don't know why. Maybe it's kind of for the scalp or something. But even more strange, sometimes we get combs in the monastery. People give us combs. I wonder, what are they thinking? I don't know what people are thinking sometimes. But I suppose they're trying to be kind, but sometimes they kind of miss the point just a little bit. Anyway, so that is all for now. For now, is that right? Is that all for now? Where's the boss? The boss isn't here. Okay, doesn't matter. So that is it. So I wish you all the very best of luck with your spiritual practice. Keep on at it. Keep on enjoying it. This is the most important part of the spiritual practice. Make sure you enjoy it. Do it with the right kind of attitude. Don't make it into a burden. Make it into something that improves the quality of your life and doesn't drag you down and make the quality of your life worse. And if you do that, you're going to have a long and prosperous spiritual life ahead of you. And it's going to be a massive blessing, not only for you, but also for everyone around you and indeed for the entire world. And that is what this path offers, and that is what it promises in the long run. Okay, so that's it. So now I'm going to say goodbye. Goodbye, everyone. And maybe we'll see you back again next year. Okay.